My guest on Great Lives today has been conveyed on some of her most famous journeys at an altitude of 3 or 4 feet. Dervla Murphy's travel and adventure writing has found her more often than not on a bicycle or with a donkey or a mule. Born in 1931 in Ireland, she's been writing about journeys for more than 40 years. For instance, the 1965 book, a huge success, Full Tilt Ireland to India with a Bicycle. Sometimes she goes alone, sometimes she's taken a child. Dervla Murphy, do you think travelling and travel writing is essentially and ideally a solitary pursuit?
I do, Matthew, because I've experimented now with travelling alone, travelling with Rachel as a child, and that's okay. But the last time Rachel and I travelled together was in Cameroon, and she was 18, so we were two adults. Mm. And that really didn't work. Two adults changed the sort of relationships I was able to make with the local people as we trekked along. We were on foot with a pack horse there in Cameroon.
Well, here is another giant of travel writing talking about exactly that.
A companion immediately isolates you. It's not only your feelings, it's that the people among whom you travel, when you're talking in another language and with each other, you remain a stranger to them. But when you're there talking their language and mixing with them, they forget that you belong to another civilization. And you can really get in with them.
Unmistakable voice. Whom have you chosen and why?
Freya's dog. Because, well, chiefly actually because I so admire her writing. Though, of course, she had considerable influence on me as a youngster when I was deciding where to go and how to go and what way I wanted to travel.
When did you first encounter her?
Almost before I can remember, because my mother was a tremendous fan of the early books describing her travels in Persia and in the Hadhramout were read to me by my mother when I was very small. My father was a librarian, so we always got the publisher's lists, and the excitement when the John Murray list showed a new Freya coming out. And then as an adolescent, I would save up my pocket money, which was very meagre, to buy the new Freya. It wasn't enough to borrow it from the library. I had to own it.
You mentioned that list. She had, didn't she, a lifelong association with one publishing house, and a long friendship with its chief
Indeed.
And patriarch.
Yes, and we have the privilege of John Murray the Seventh with us.
We do indeed. As our expert in the studio,
yes.
Freya's godson and Jock Murray's son, John, the last of a long line of publishers called John Murray and the seventh of that name. John, what are your very earliest memories of Freya Stark?
Well, I was, of course, brought up with her. And she was extremely nice to me, partly because I was a male. She couldn't really take women, so my sisters suffered terribly. I suppose my first memory was when a maid in a house we were staying with suddenly screamed after breakfast. Nobody knew what had happened until it was discovered that Freya's lizard, which she had brought from the Hadhramout, had jumped out of the drawer she'd put it in when the maid had opened it to put her things back in.
Tell me, Dervla Murphy, about her early years.
She had a very, very difficult childhood, really, because her parents' marriage was not very happy. Freya and her sister lived with her mother in Italy. And then they became involved, her mother became involved with an Italian, a sort of
Svengali,
ninny.
An appalling man. Absolutely
I was going
appalling.
To say a ninny aristocrat.
I have no idea what it was that caught her mother. She was there for 16 years.
And she had, Dervla, an awful accident at this time, didn't
appalling,
she?
Appalling, yes, to do with the factory, the machinery.
Yes, it was a carpet factory.
Yes.
And they'd put in a new machine.
They'd started a carpet factory, had they?
No,
as
no.
A family.
Mario had had one.
Yes.
And Flora, Freya's mother, came in to help run it.
But what happened with her hair?
She was almost 13. It was a few weeks before her 13th birthday. She went in with her mother and sister to look at some new machinery. and her very long hair, below waist length, was caught up in the machinery. She was whirled around, and part of her scalp actually torn off.
Oh.
Pretty gruesome.
But one has to realise that Freya realised before then that she wasn't a beauty. She always said that she never regretted not having a full education, but she regretted not having beauty. And I think the fact that this led it one stage further probably was a part of what made her what eventually she became. And so I think one's saddened by it, but when you ever look at Freya, her hair was always down over one side to conceal the scar. And this gave her real personality.
As to her education, let's have her speak for herself.
Where did you go to school, Miss Stark?
I didn't go to school.
You didn't go to school?
No. I read a great deal. We had a good library. And otherwise, I was never educated. And the one thing I never regret is not having been educated.
Derbler Murphy, when Freya Stark finally came out of the library as a young woman, what did she go off to do?
Well, she was determined to learn Arabic. She began to learn it, actually, from a retired missionary priest who lived near her home in Italy. Then she went on to SOAS. No, Bedford College, was it?
Bedford College for a while, and then after that, SOAS briefly.
Because she sets off for the Lebanon with the aim of teaching herself Arabic and travelling into the Druze-controlled areas. And there's a quote from her here, "I never imagined that my first sight of the desert would come with such a shock of beauty and enslave me right away. But I left it feeling that somehow, sometime, I must see more of the great spaces."
She knew that she wanted space.
Yes.
And freedom.
I think space is the real thing. She said it didn't matter where she went, as long as she got space. Well, one knows quite, she said Africa and places, but one knows quite well Africa wasn't the place. The Middle East and the desert was the only place which would satisfy Freya in this way.
Well, here she is in 1976 talking about exactly those people and those places that were going to become the focus of her life.
Do you think there is a link between Arabia and the English, one almost might say the English romantic? It does seem to draw English people of a certain temperament, doesn't it?
Well, they like the Arab, and the Arab likes them. There is a sympathy. I think we have rather the same values.
In what sort of way?
They look for real things more than for show. They're very, very good judges of people, and however down at heel and scruffy you may be travelling about, they know at once whether you have the qualities that they consider essential and which we consider essential. And we like the same jokes.
Is that so?
Yeah.
Did you, Derbler, ever feel this romantic pull of Arabia and the
Middle East? No. I mean, even Freya, devoted as I was to her writing, couldn't attract me to the desert. I hate heat. I go for the mountains and cold places.
And a bicycle across the dunes.
That would be the wrong thing.
No.
John Murray, it was her article about this trip, that first trip into the desert for Cornhill magazine, that you might say did set the course of the rest of her life.
Yes, well, the first one was when she went, the only time she went with another lady, her friend Venetia, went up to Jebel Druze in Syria. And that was followed then by the Valley of the Assassins, which was one of her first, really, it was the first trip she went by herself. But when she came back and she wrote it, my father published it, everybody came to her door. In fact, she got medals from the Royal Geographical Society and from the Asiatic Society, and she gave lectures. She suddenly became a personality, and from that moment she never looked back.
What is it, Derbler, about her writing that first grabbed you? Is it the places she went to, the things she did, or her literary quality as well?
Oh, the literary quality, without question.
How would you characterise it?
Well, I don't think she ever puts a word wrong, actually.
As her publisher, I might disagree with you. I think in her letters, it was marvellous because they had immediacy.
Yes.
As she wrote her book, she polished and polished. She's a real stylist. She never believed in adjectives.
But the way she used adjectives is one of the most extraordinary things.
Yes, but she always believed you should incorporate an adjective into a verb wherever you could, and the verb should tell you.
There are similarities with your own writing. One thinks of you as a traveller as well as a writer, and the journey with you, Derva, is just as important as the particular things discovered in the journey.
Oh, yes, that's true.
But also it's interesting that Derva, and I know this because I've worked with Derva a lot, she wrote a diary. All her early books were a diary, which took you through with the real honesty of what happened from day to day. That's what makes Derva totally different from Frere. Frere wrote letters or wrote a beautifully crafted book. Derva writes a journal as she goes, and you're absolutely compelled to continue on with her.
Was Frere an honest writer, do you think? Did she slightly big herself up and exaggerate her exploits?
I don't think she did, but she did create her own legend. A lot of things have been made up by Frere, but they've been made up because they are Frere. And if you didn't make it up, you wouldn't feel that it was Frere. So I'm all in favour of people making up things in their autobiographies.
Derva, if you were to be giving advice to a young travel writer, not on writing, but on travelling.
Well, I think one of them would be what Frere discovered. She showed me at a stage long before there were any hippies around that you could travel very far with very little money and very few possessions, and you didn't have to depend in any way on links with home. I think that was hugely important.
Well, I once stayed with Frere at a place called Candili on the Bosphorus, when I persuaded Frere to let me swim the Bosphorus from Europe to Asia. But what really took me unawares, I just left Oxford, and she started by trying to teach me the facts of life. And, of course, she didn't know the facts of life, so it didn't help. However, I swam the Bosphorus.
Did she swim with you?
No, she was in a boat with a Turkish oarsman, and we had to have a large rope behind because these vast Russian tankers came down.
She had a massive falling out, Derva, with two women fellow travellers. Was it
Hell
in Yemen?
Yes. Well, you would describe it, I suppose, as a very foolish expedition to begin with. I mean, completely incompatible characters. A very austere, scholarly, couldn't be bothered with the natives, archaeologist. Highly qualified and, I would think, quite self-important, really. And then Frere, with her completely different approach to being there and to the local people.
She tells an extraordinary story that Gertrude Thompson, who was one of them, had money and had bought a vast lock to put on her door.
Yes.
And she put the money in her room and locked it up. Frere says she handed her money over to the cook to keep. Well, what happened? Gertrude Thompson's was stolen and Frere got hers back, which didn't help the relationship.
Well, that's one of the Frere stories I can easily believe. But she really rings true.
She wrote a book afterwards, didn't she, tearing her two companions to shreds?
Oh, she wrote A Winter in Arabia. Hmm. But my father, I think,
intervened
because it was not only libelous, but it was destructive for everybody. I have to say that the two of them were vicious about her when they came back. Hmm. They spread the most awful rumours, as if they couldn't have understood that taking Frere with them, who liked travelling by herself, on an expedition which needed three Europeans and protection from the locals. Frere loved mixing with the locals. I mean, what led her to do this? I simply don't know.
This is BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and you're listening to Great Lives, where this week my guest, Derva Murphy, has chosen the life of the travel writer Frere Stark. Her godson and the son of her publisher, John Murray, is our expert witness. She did manage to make herself useful to the British government during the Second World War because she'd always been keen to be a player.
The British decided to use her for propaganda. She was in Aden and she was sent into the Yemen with a cine projector and lots of propaganda films. And there's a wonderful photograph of her sitting on a large sort of dais holding the microphone and giving a fluent commentary in Arabic while the film was shown of the British Navy moving around the Mediterranean. And the purpose was to persuade them not to support the Italians or the Germans. And Frere said to me, the great thing with propaganda is never say anything you don't believe in. Mm. And if, in fact, the British were suffering, make it clear, but say all the plans were there for them to overcome their enemy.
She was quite a British imperialist.
Oh, yes, very much so.
Mm.
But on the other hand, she could see quite clearly why the empire was about to collapse, as it was, obviously, in the 1940s. And even though she was such a loyal imperialist, she was not blind to the defects that was bringing about the end of the empire.
She had a sticky time with American public opinion, as I understand it.
She went then in 1943, wasn't 43. It? October 43. She went to America on behalf of the British government to explain their, as they put it, their position on Palestine at the time. And then she had another of her awful illnesses in the troop ship taking her across to Canada. She developed inflamed appendix, and then it burst just as they were getting her ashore. She jolly nearly died.
But the main problem,
and in 2 weeks she'd recovered, and she was off on this, you know, grueling lecture tour.
But the main problem, I think, in America was Zionism.
Oh, yes. Mm.
The Palestinians, she believed in limited Zionism. She had nothing against that. She saw that Jewish people had lived in that area. But what she couldn't bear was the idea that Zionists were going to push more and more of their kind into Palestine. And the trouble is, she had met her match with the Americans. They simply couldn't understand what she was getting at.
True.
Towards the end of the Second World War, she moved out further east again, didn't she, John?
After Freya had been in Cairo for a while with the Brotherhood of Freedom, which was again a part of what we call propaganda and she likes to call persuasion, she was with Lord Wavell, and she made tremendous friends of Lord Wavell. And when he went out to be Governor-General in India, she followed him out. But just as the war finished, she had to stop, and then she decided to drive from Delhi right over to Tehran. But on the way, she came across inter-tribal wars.
And here she is talking about that. Mm.
There are several from India that might be of interest. My darling Pam, Baluchistan is a fine rugged country. The people up here are Pathans, very big and biblical, with black beards and eyes like spaniels. They wear lots of loose cotton draperies, very untidily, wash twice a year, lock their wives up when they go out, with every reason to do so, it seems, and manage to live in a country which, to the casual traveller, seems to have hardly any houses or cultivation at all.
How about her personal life, Dervla? Did she have a personal life at this time?
Well, a personal life in the sense of an extraordinary array of friends.
But there was a marriage too, wasn't there?
Well, yes, but it didn't quite work, did it, John?
Well, I must say that it showed her naivety.
Yes.
It's always said it was with Stuart Perrone, who'd been out in Aden with her, and they had a lot in common. They were both historians. They loved history. He was an Arabist because he'd been in Aden. They had lots of what you might call intellectual meeting points. But Freya didn't understand that Stuart Perrone wasn't exactly that way inclined. And evidently, when she proposed to him, which I think she did, he sent her a telegram which he didn't construe quite right. It was in Latin, which was to make clear to her that it was an intellectual marriage.
A friend, his name was Nigel, recalled a curious conversation with her about this. She asked him about Stuart, why, she wanted to know, was he not married already? You are absurd, everyone knows, Nigel remembered saying, taken aback that Freya apparently was unaware that Stuart was gay. Come on, Nigel, what don't I know, she persisted, that Stuart is queer. Freya looked thoughtful. I don't think for a minute there's anything peculiar about Stuart Perrone, she finally answered. I'm using queer in the technical sense, said Nigel. What does that mean? Queer in the technical sense means homosexual. Oh, like the ancient Greeks. And that was that. Freya declined to explore the subject further. How did your family take the news of this marriage, John?
Appalling. To begin with, that my Freya had written to my father when he was marrying my mother to say on no account should he marry my mother, because he didn't want my father to take his attention off her. And my mother actually was treated so appallingly by Freya.
She
totally refused to come to any of the festivities. My father allowed them to be married from Albemarle Street, but knew quite well it wouldn't last a moment.
Did you see much of her at the time, Dermot?
No, no. I met her, I think, in all three times at, when we were both staying at Cannon Lodge. Mm. But I always remember the first time because I was so overawed at actually meeting her. I was speechless, you know. I had absolutely nothing to say for myself. And she quite clearly regarded me as superfluous, so she didn't do anything to make me feel...
And you were a woman.
Less in awe, yes.
Mm. Yeah, she couldn't bear women, really, and when she had her 70th birthday party, it was her and 17 men.
Didn't it hurt your feelings, you who
admired
her so much?
Not even slightly, no. No, because I'd read all her four volumes of autobiography, and I actually felt sorry for her because I think she was, deep down, she was a very insecure person.
I think this is something that nobody realised right through to the end, the insecurity. Mm. And in a way, she was ruthless using her friends, and she was ruthless because, in a way, if you like playing a Baroque trumpet, if you blow lightly, you can't make a noise. You can only make a noise if you really buff into it. And I think Freya was like that. If she was ruthless with her friends and used them to the ultimate, she got through. But the moment she relaxed, I think she was in trouble because of this insecurity.
Mm. Was she a snob?
I think she became so. Yes. Mm. I think it all rather went to her head.
Oh, she loved grand living. She used to stay with at Hatfield with the Salisburys, with the Astors at Clifton, with the Nicholsons at Sissinghurst, at Petworth.
Met David Sessler for the first time at Petworth.
Really?
Yeah, in the 30s.
I know, she went everywhere, and the Chumleys at Houghton. I mean, she loved this, and, you know, it was a nightmare organising
it. Not to mention the Queen Mother.
And the Queen Mother
up in North. That wonderful photograph of the tooth.
Yes. No, she loved grand life, and she, of course, gave much more than she took.
She made impossible demands of her publisher.
Oh, my poor father. She was a nightmare. I mean, he'd get a telegram from her saying, will you please go through to Imperial Airways and arrange the special ticket for me to Cairo, and then I want 3 days in Cairo shopping, and I then want to go to Aden, and then I want a boat which is going to take me round the coast from Aden to Makalla, and I want to be there on Thursday the 17th.
And then she ordered a tin bath to be sent out.
Oh, the other thing was she endlessly has a hip bath to the Hadramaut through the diplomatic bag. Well, you know, in those days you could send things like that, but the organisation, and the secret was you never believed anything was impossible when she asked you to do it. I was once asked to take 7 rose plants to Italy for her. I had to go through the customs. They were banned. She said, don't worry, just put them into your suitcase and put your dirty clothing on top of them. Well, as if I was taking dirty clothing to stay with her. And I went through the customs. I got through. I got there, and I swore I would never, ever, ever do anything like that for her again. 3 years later, I was staying with her, and in the evening, I said, Freya, what's that wonderful fragrance? Oh, she said, those are the roses you brought out. And so I gave in. I capitulated.
I'm growing more and more intrigued, though, Dervla, by your admiration for this woman. She was a British imperialist. You aren't. She cared a lot about how she looked. You don't.
No.
She was a bit of a snob. You aren't.
I hope not.
She was rebuffed your attempts at friendship, and yet you seem to admire her so much.
Well, it is actually her writing, and you know, that's what counts for me, and the rest is just somewhere out there in the periphery and doesn't awfully matter.
And then, Dervla, come the last years of her life, and you saw her during the last years of her life.
Well, what struck me when I met her was I couldn't understand why she'd always had this sad worry about her appearance, because my immediate impression was, you know, of some face animated with, you know, intelligence and wit and imagination. You couldn't think of her as a plain person, and yet she repeatedly used that word of her appearance throughout the books, beginning very early letters to her mother. And how it came about that somebody of her enormous talent could worry about looking plain when she didn't anyway.
And she slowly lost her mind. Do you think she knew that she was losing her grip when you met her at the end?
Oh, well, at the very end, I went, somebody, I can't remember now whether it was The Observer or The Guardian, somebody asked me to interview her for her 90th birthday. So I went out in 1983, well, actually it was the autumn of 82, to Oslo. And, I mean, she had then, you know, she had become so vague that it was actually impossible to interview her. So we just... I mean, she associated me with Jock and made me very welcome on that account.
Hmm.
And I brought out all my first editions for her to autograph, which she was very happy to do, and autographed them in Arabic too, and wrote a very nice inscription in one of them for my daughter, Rachel. So, but it was a very sad occasion because it was impossible to have a real conversation with her. Then when I came back, Jock helped me with the interview. You know, I showed it, the outline to him, and he worked a bit on it, and we cobbled it together.
This is what she said herself about the end.
How do you treat old age?
I think I like to look over the edge and see what's coming. But people don't much. They rather avoid it as a rule, and I think that's wrong. That the world is divided. There's something that is given to every living creature that has eyes, whether it's a tiny mosquito or an elephant. And that's a horizon. And the world is divided by the people to whom the horizon is something they want to get over and see what beyond. And the people who feel that the horizon is their safety and it keeps them protected. And I'm one of the people who like to look over the horizon, and then there's another horizon, and then there's another horizon. And then eventually you step over your last horizon. And that, I think, is the fascination of life, and the idea of death is still an idea of travelling beyond the last horizon.
My thanks to our guest, Dervla Murphy, who chose the great life of Freya Stark, and to our expert witness, John Murray. It's a nice way to end it. That's what you started by talking
marvelous.
About.
I mean, it's absolutely glorious.
What a lovely voice she has.
Yes.
Oh, she
has.
Absolutely magical.
People don't talk like that anymore.
No. And so carefully.
Yes.
I mean, every word is chosen.
Yes.